You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, March 4th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the steps of the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. On the program today, interviews with lawyers, advocates, all calling or expressing an opinion on the King versus Burwell case. Oral arguments have just finished literally minutes ago, ladies and gentlemen. I'm hoping to have some folks from reporters who were in the court hearing the arguments joining me today. I don't know if we'll be able to get them because they very often in this situation need to run back to their offices to file a story. But hopefully we'll have some of those folks with us today. Matt and Michael got to let me know if my microphone is loud enough. I'm not quite sure that we have settled on the concept of giving me feedback. meanwhile, I do have some interviews that I've recorded either this morning or yesterday afternoon, pre-recorded, that I will play of interviews that I did over the past couple of days. Hopefully we'll have a, like I say, if not in person, perhaps an update from some reporters who were sitting inside the court as the program goes on. I will read reports as they're coming out, different opinions, and we'll, of course, follow up on this in the coming days. Let's start off with an interview I did with Cy Lazarus. He is an attorney from the Constitutional Law Center. I've spoken to him in the past at this, at the Health Action Conference, sponsored by the same people who are sponsoring this Radio Row Families USA. And one of the things I was interested in talking to him about, which we get to towards the end of the interview, is what the implications for the legal profession would be in terms of the way they view the Supreme Court in the event that they sided with plaintiffs in a case that, by all accounts, seems ludicrous. Ludicrous even that they took, particularly the timing in which they took it, without a circuit court split or one that had settled, let's say. All right, so let's start this interview with Simon Lazarus, and we'll take a quick, I guess, musical interlude, and then go there.
Yeah.
Continuing our coverage from the Supreme Court of the United States, the case is King versus Burwell. We are steps across the street from the Supreme Court. Joining me here on Radio Row is Simon Lazarus. He is the senior counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center. Simon, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, this is a great pleasure.
So, I mean, from your perspective, and we've spoken to many, I guess, Supreme Court watchers and attorneys, law professors about this case. From your perspective, what is the most unique aspect of this case in terms of whether it's the way that the court is approaching it, the fact that they took it at this point? What stands out for you about this case, aside from obviously the massive implications it could have for everyday people?
Well, the most unique aspect of this case is that these diehard opponents of the Affordable Care Act are inviting the Supreme Court to strip access to health care from at least 10 million people and have much more serious adverse effects on the access of many other people who will find their premiums skyrocketing if they rule in favor of these challengers. The most significant aspect is that this has never happened. In the history of the Supreme Court, the court has never undone a law that is providing such widespread benefits and taking those benefits away. Has never happened, even during the New Deal, when in the early years there were a bunch of old conservatives who were violently opposed to the New Deal and ruled significant parts of it unconstitutional. Those parts had not really gone into effect yet, really, and the benefits weren't being provided. So this would be a step over a red line for the Supreme Court.
So, if I'm hearing you correctly, it's the timing, it's the fact that this is a legislation that is in place is largely working. I mean, people can disagree about the way in which it works, and they may have wanted it to do something different, but it is largely working the way it was supposed to be working.
That is absolutely correct. And the other aspect of this is that the interpretation of the law that the challengers are putting forward, which would turn the law upside down and on its head, is so off the wall. It is an interpretation that is totally contrary to what everyone involved in the fight over passing the Affordable Care Act understood the law to do, including Republicans and conservatives who opposed the law. It was only thought up several months after the law was passed. It is contrary to what the overall statute clearly means and the way in which courts usually interpret the law. So to adopt such a far-fetched, upside-down interpretation of the law in a way that strips already provided benefits from so many millions of people would make this a completely unprecedented decision. One distinguished commentator called it a naked power grab. I think it's very unlikely that the Supreme Court will do that.
All right, well, I want to get to that in a moment, but I want to reiterate the idea of just how settled this question of subsidies existing in these 36 states, I guess, that are where the exchange is run by the federal government. In the last big Affordable Care Act case, the four conservative justices were making the point themselves that Congress intended these to be subsidies that would work. I mean, that's how the whole system works. Yes, I mean, can you just tease that out for us a little bit, and just to show sort of the, from a legal perspective, just how much the court would have to twist itself into pretzels, assuming those four justices would be part of a finding in favor of the plaintiff, which I think is a fairly safe assumption if that happens. I mean, explain to us just how much gymnastics would be involved in that.
Well, you've put your finger on a very important point, and that is that the four justices who dissented in 2012, when five justices upheld the ACA's individual mandate, and seven justices ruled that the Medicaid expansion could go forward on somewhat modified terms. Those four justices, who are conservative justices, all very eloquently and accurately spelled out that in their terms, what they said was, without the tax credits and subsidies, the Affordable Care Act exchanges couldn't work as intended and quite possibly couldn't work at all. That's exactly what they said. That is exactly the case. What the Affordable Care Act does to fill this gap our system has had in ensuring that people have access to affordable insurance, it set up these exchanges to make facilitate competition among insurers for people who do not have access to group health plans provided by their employer. Secondly, it created the individual mandate to encourage healthy as well as unhealthy people to
buy
insurance.
Right, make sure there's no freeloaders.
Right, and make sure there's no freeloaders, exactly. And thirdly, it provided for tax credits and subsidies in order to make the mandated insurance affordable. Without the tax credits and subsidies, as the Supreme Court justices who dissented pointed out, the act can't work.
And so in the context of the legal question here, which is one of statutory interpretation, right? Why is that so important?
That's important because it shows what Congress intended. It shows how all of the different parts of the act that are involved here are interdependent, which is a word that those justices used, and therefore that reinforces the administration's interpretation that the credits and subsidies should be available, and if the act is properly construed, are available nationwide in all states. It also supports, there is a so-called a principle about how judges should interpret ambiguous terms in statutes, if you think that the statute's interpret is ambiguous. And that is, this principle says that an interpretation should not be adopted which leads to the statute or the part of the statute being interpreted leads to it becoming ineffective. So on that basis, that observation by those justices would doubly reinforce the correctness of the administration's position.
How debased does your perspective of the Supreme Court become in the event that they find for plaintiffs here? You know, I mean, for me personally, since 2000, it's been tricky for me to have the same sort of level of respect as an institution. I'm just curious.
I'll tell you a personal story if you got time for it, which would
yes.
have been there.
Please.
The Saturday morning when the Supreme in 2000, when the Supreme Court was considering the Bush lawyers' petition to review the Georgia Supreme Court's decision that there should be a recount. I mean, the Florida Supreme Court's
right.
decision that should be a recount. I was with one of my friends in a locker room after we played tennis. And this friend happened to be a very prominent Supreme Court lawyer and actually government official. And so he was saying, wrapped in his towel, that there's no way in which these conservative justices who believe in states' rights would ever overturn a state Supreme Court's interpretation of its own law. So they're going to throw this case out right away. And everybody in the locker room, in their towels, all gathered around to listen to this sage expert. Well, of course, about an hour later, the Supreme Court took the case. And we all know what happened in Bush v. Gore. At the time, people thought they had awarded the election to Bush and that this was a hideously partisan decision. So I have to say that as someone who follows the court very closely and reveres the court, I think that buying this hoked-up, completely upside-down interpretation of the Affordable Care Act to gut it would be an even more gross abuse of the court's power frankly, than Bush v. Gore.
Where does it leave it for people like yourself who revere the court?
I honestly don't believe it will happen. This is what the challengers are trying to persuade the court to do. I think for the reasons that you stated earlier in the broadcast, that the justices are very well aware that these tax credits and subsidies are completely integral to the functioning of the act, and an interpretation that would rule them illegal would make no sense whatsoever. And I am confident that a strong majority of the justices are going to rule on that basis.
Well, I have your contact information. I hope you're right. If you're wrong, we're going to have to reconvene, because I'm fascinated by how people who have such reverence for the court have been sort of rolling with these series of findings. But Simon Lazarus, thanks so much for your time today. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is the first interview I have for you. Like I say, the oral arguments have ended in the case. There are some updates. Let me remind you just a little bit of house cleaning. I'm on the road here, and so the order of things get mixed up a little bit. A little bit of house cleaning. You can vote now, right now, as soon as you hear me say this, for the Majority Report as the best news and politics program at podcastawards.com. Got to scroll down the page, podcastawards.com. Vote for us. You got to put your email address in and then check to see if they have checked your email address to confirm it. You can vote every day. And you can be sure that those who are voting for the other shows are voting every day. And the other aspect is that you cannot make up for it. In other words, there is no rush of voting at the end. Because there you can vote every day, it's crucial that you do. Podcastawards.com. The updates I have seen so far on those people who I follow on this on these things, and I've only actually seen, I guess, really one update. Well, I've seen some arguments updated. In other words, in terms of what happened. I mean, each the oral arguments lasted, I think, about 30 to 40 minutes each. I should say each for both the petitioner, the plaintiff in this case, and the government. In the beginning of the case, while the petitioner was being questioned, apparently Justice Kennedy expressed some concern that the statute that or the idea that states who had not established their own exchange wouldn't be eligible, or their citizens would not be eligible for subsidies. He expressed some concern that this would destroy the insurance industry. And he also suggested that if the law was set up to deprive citizens of any given state subsidies for health insurance, if the state did not choose to set up the exchange and instead deferred to the federal government, Kennedy expressed some notion that that would be unduly coercive by the federal government. Now, of course, the irony here is that is also the argument that was furthered by the conservative justices as to why the federal government could not say you've got to take the expansion of Medicaid or you don't get any Medicaid. The court found that too coercive, even though... leaving aside why I find that reasoning to be a little bit ridiculous. But so that same principle, which denies hundreds of thousands, if not a couple million, actually, people who would otherwise be eligible for coverage under an expanded Medicaid could be the reasoning that ultimately maintains the subsidies for states that did not choose to establish their own exchange, but instead had the federal government do it. Apparently, then also Justice Kagan, in questioning the petitioners, provided a hypothetical that went right to the point regarding how you interpret a statute and the importance of context. She gave a scenario that basically went something like this. She says, if I tell Clerk A to write a memo, and let's substitute Clerk A for Michael. Or actually, let's substitute Clerk A for Matt. If I tell Matt to write me a memo, and I tell Michael to edit that memo before I get it. Now, I know, in real life, not only do I not see the first draft of the memo, but I don't see the edit. It never happens. I keep asking them over and over again for the memo. They just don't do it. But leave that aside for a moment. This is a hypothetical. I ask Matt, write me a memo. I say to Michael, I want you to edit the memo I've asked Matt to write me. It's a memo on the best practices for posting on Facebook. Matt turns out to be too busy because he's got a WWF, I don't know, field trip planned to see wrestling. And so I ask Dorsey, who no longer works for me, but I asked Dorsey to write the memo. Does it make sense at that point that even though I've asked Michael to edit the memo, that he doesn't because he says, well, Matt didn't write it, so I don't need to edit the memo? No, of course not. Common sense says that if I want the memo edited, it's not because I want it edited because Matt wrote it. It's because I want the memo and I want two people to work on it. That's basically the scenario that Kagan offered. And the petitioner, the lawyer for the plaintiff, said, well, it depends, Justice Kagan, if you think there's a material difference between Matt's ability to write the memo and Dorsey's ability to write the memo as to whether or not you want Michael to edit it. And Justice Kagan came back with, well, okay, exactly, but that proves my point too, insofar as context matters. And in which case, you cannot determine the intent of that legislation based upon, she didn't carry it this far, the intent of the legislation based upon four words that are embedded and not even embedded in the operative part of the statute. In other words, it was not, these four words were written not in the section of the statute that said who's eligible for subsidies, but rather was an aside about the explanation of exchanges. So that's what we've heard. Apparently, John Roberts did not ask any questions of the petitioners, which some people find a little worrisome. Because the last time he did that was in the case in Massachusetts, which involved a protective ring around escorts to women who were going into abortion clinics. So we shall see. But we're going to take a break. Listen to another interview I did with Robert Weiner. He is a partner at a private firm, Arnold and Porter, in Washington, but he helped write the amicus brief for Families USA. He had an interesting take on the case as well. So let's listen to that interview now. We're back continuing our coverage from literally across the street from the Supreme Court of the United States. We are here in Washington, D.C. for the oral arguments in Halbig versus Burwell. This is a case that's going to have massive implications for the Affordable Care Act if the court finds in favor of the plaintiffs. Joining me now is Robert Weiner. He is an attorney at
Arnold and Porter in Washington, D.C.
And you guys have filed an amicus brief on behalf of Families USA. You were formerly in the Department of Justice working on the litigation for the first major Affordable Care Act case, I guess now in 2012.
That's right.
So give us a sense. We know there's been a lot of, obviously there's a lot of amicus briefs that are filed. When you write one on behalf of Families USA, what is the, is there a specific legal argument that you're making in the in your brief?
Well, yes. What I tried to do was to state the statutory issues as clearly and as understandably as possible. But I also wanted to show how the Affordable Care Act is working, because when courts interpret statutes, you assume that Congress wants the statute to work. That is a fair presumption. They're rational upon Capitol Hill. At least that's the assumption you make in interpreting statutes. And so the act is working. If the court goes the other way in this case, it won't work. And so there is a presumption, if the language can possibly support it, that you interpret the statute to work.
So, in other words, I mean, we're operating here in the realm of statutory interpretation.
That's right.
How do you read what Congress has written? And because no language is precise, and you read things in context. And here, what we're talking about is literally four or five words that say that subsidies or tax credits are only available to people who enter into an exchange, that's the marketplaces in the states, that is established by a state. Now, it says that in one place, and those of us who are lay people would assume, if we just look at those words, then they're only available to people who enter into an exchange established by the state. There's only 14 of those. The other 36 were established by the federal government on behalf of the states. So why, as a layperson, I look at that, why isn't that the case?
So first of all, when you listen to the argument of the other side, you would think there is a provision in the law that says you only get subsidies in an exchange established by the state. That's not what the statute says. Statute says you get subsidies if you are between 100% and 400% of the poverty level. For an individual, if you make between $11,000 and $45,000 approximately dollars per year. That's what it says. And then when you get to a point where it says how you calculate the subsidy you get, it says that you calculate it based on the price of insurance on an exchange established by the state. So it's not in the part where it says what exchanges are. It's not in the part where it talks about what states are supposed to do. It's not in the part about who gets subsidies. It's in the part about how you calculate them. It's buried there. And that's not the way you would put something in a statute that's that important, particularly when it tanks the insurance markets in all these states.
And so for the sake of lay people to understand, it's like, you know, if you, when you sign a contract, there are certain areas, this is the term of the contract, that's how long it is,
right,
or this is the definitions of who the people are entering into this contract. So what you're saying is that the provision that they're relying upon is not in a section of the statute wherein it is to determine who gets subsidies.
Precisely. That's a very good analogy. And the reason it's a particularly good analogy is that this is like a contract with the states. Because the states, if you're going to try, I mean, what the other side says is they they made subsidies available only on exchanges established by states in order to induce them to establish exchanges. Well, if you're going to threaten a state or coerce a state like that, you have to tell them. You have to tell them clearly. 22 states filed a brief in this case, and they said, we didn't know. Nobody knew. Nobody understood the statute this way.
That's right. I mean, there was no one who's interpreted it contemporaneously or really until very recently, it appears. Well, all right, so let me ask you this. I mean, you started by talking about the sort of the broader way in which statutes are interpreted, and they must be seen in context. There must be some... You must give deference when a law is working. You must give deference to it, particularly if the actions you're going to take as a court are going to basically trash the law. What if Anton Scalia makes the argument, this is a dumb law? I hate it. It's stupid. It's wrong. It's ill-conceived. And so that notion that it's working, it can't possibly work, because even as it's functioning the way that Congress wanted to, it was stupid to begin with.
Well, that's not really the role of a judge. The role of a judge in interpreting a statute is to try to implement what the will of Congress was. I think the will of Congress here is crystal clear, and the evidence just establishes it overwhelmingly. Put it the other way, when the evidence establishes what Congress intended, it's really troubling for judges who aren't elected to say it means something else.
And that's generally, I mean, to the extent that when we talk about sort of the conservative, classical conservative ideology, I guess, of legal interpretation or of how judges should be perform, they tend to defer to that, right? I mean, or at least in rhetoric.
They used to, and I think that I think there's a lot of principled conservative judges out there who still do. And I think you find very spotty support for this argument among conservative jurists. You really don't see a lot of the people you'd expect to see out there supporting their case.
Who's filed amicus briefs on behalf of the plaintiff? I mean, I'm just curious because, you know, it's quite obvious who's filing amicus briefs on behalf of the government. It is insurance companies. It is hospitals. It is people who might lose their health insurance. It is then law professors who are talking about the different aspects of statutory interpretation. I'm just curious, who's filing these amicus briefs on the other side?
Well, I don't have a full list, but it's a number of these very conservative advocacy groups like the Pacific Legal Foundation and the American Union for Civil Liberties or something like that. It is sort of the usual suspects.
Is there anything in those briefs that struck you as like, okay, that's somewhat reasonable, or that's, you know, within, it's within, at least I'm in the same city as that ballpark?
Well, I think that what they have going for them is they have a very simple argument. They say the statute says established by the state. The federal government is not a state, and therefore this is not an exchange established by a state, and you can't get subsidies. It's just not that simple. It's simple when you take the few words in isolation and say yes.
But nobody's ever interpreted law that way.
Well, you know, I think that nobody has, but hopefully this will not be the first time.
All right. Robert Wiener, thank you so much for your time today. Genuinely appreciate it.
Sure thing. Enjoyed it.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. I have an interview that hopefully was recorded okay with Congresswoman Barbara Lee, which we'll get to in a moment. Let's play an interview with Wendell Potter, which I did earlier today. Hopefully that one is in good shape. Continuing our coverage here at the across the street from the Supreme Court of the United States on the day that oral arguments will begin on the Affordable Care Act case King versus Burwell. Joining me is on this program a longtime guest on this program. Always happy to see him, Wendell Potter. He's the senior analyst at the Center for Public Integrity. Of course, also the author of Deadly Spin and Obamacare, What's in It for Me. Wendell, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be back.
Now, Wendell, hopefully my audience knows that nobody understands the minds of insurance executives like you do. You were a former insurance executive.
Right.
Who, I guess, came to see the light in some ways.
Right.
But let's talk about, you have a piece, I think it's out today, in fact, saying that regardless of who wins here, we can expect price increases on our insurance. Why is that?
Yeah, it has something to do with the timing of when the Supreme Court will actually announce its decision. Of course, the hearing is today. They're hearing arguments today. They'll probably vote within the next few days. But they won't announce that decision until probably late June. Well, insurance companies are already trying to figure out what they're going to be charging people in 2016. And by the time mid-June comes around, they will have to have decided what they're going to do. So there will be this uncertainty hanging over the industry about which way this case will go. They will build in to their rates a worst-case scenario. What if the Supreme Court rules against the government? That means that a lot of people would lose their subsidies and consequently their insurance. That will result in prices being higher for everybody. So they're going to be pricing their policies to make sure they've got some cushion to get them through 2016 because of this uncertainty. So everybody who gets coverage in these states, these 34 states, will see their prices, their insurance go up just because the Supreme Court decided to take this case on.
Well, but they can't possibly price in the cost of losing whatever 7 to 11 million customers, though, can they? Or
they can't price it. They can't do as much as they would like to, but they can increase the rates enough to give them a cushion. What will happen if the Supreme Court rules for the plaintiffs here? It will set into motion something called adverse selection.
All right. Before we get into that and death spirals and but let's just assume for a moment that the Supreme Court does not find in favor of the plaintiffs. Wouldn't regulators in the states say, like, you can't raise your rates this much to cover what you thought was going to be a Supreme Court ruling against you?
Keep in mind that in these 34 states, they're largely Republican states with Republican right. regulators who will probably be looking the other way and not care that much.
All right. That makes sense to me. All right. So let's get to the other scenario. And this is the thing that sort of fascinates me, I guess, in a morbid fashion in some way, because obviously this is going to cause real pain to people. Some studies say 10,000 people could lose their lives in this scenario. So the plaintiffs prevail. Let's not get into the ridiculousness and the implications on the Supreme Court. You've got 7 to 11 million people who have to drop out of the exchanges. Mm-hmm. Presumably they get hardships, right? Exemptions from having to have insurance because they can't afford it. It's now 9%, greater than 9% of their income.
That's right.
They're not getting subsidies. Then what happens?
Well, then when they start dropping out, keep in mind that the people who will be dropping out will be those who are probably the youngest and the healthiest. Those who are sick or have the money, they're probably sick and have the money to be able to buy coverage, they're the ones that will stay in the market. When you change the what they call the risk pool that much, when it skews more to people who are not as healthy and not as young, then the insurance companies will raise the rates even more. And that's what results in what was referred to as adverse selection.
And so do they have the ability to raise the rates enough to cover up for that risk pool? In other words, they are still stuck with all the provisions that supposedly was a trade-off between
right.
You get new customers, but you get regulations that actually make your product real.
Right.
Will they be able to cover it, or will see insurance companies go bankrupt? I mean,
lot of them will leave the market, and we've seen in the past that that has happened in states that have done this would set into place. In Kentucky, and even in New York and Washington and other states, they tried in the past to reform the health insurance marketplace by passing what they referred to as guaranteed issue regulation or laws that require insurance companies to offer coverage to everybody. When you do that without offering subsidies or a requirement that people buy insurance, then that really skews the market. Only the healthiest and youngest will drop out because they'll know that if they get sick, they can buy coverage at any time they want to.
Right. So there's no... So anybody's... any potential fantasies of, like, this is going to destroy the private insurance industry... We should sort of get those out of our heads.
Get it out of your head. Now, what will happen is that people will undoubtedly have fewer choices, but the insurance industry is not going to go away. They'll still be in business. But in Kentucky, we saw when they tried that several years ago that there were more than 40 insurance companies in the state offering individual insurance. That went down to two pretty quickly when adverse selection started taking effect. There were a few that stayed in the business, but the rates they offered were so expensive that they had fewer and fewer customers.
So do the insurance companies that are stuck in these 34 states, again, we're in the scenario where the plaintiffs prevail, the insurance companies, they leave those states, or let's say, I don't know, some percentage of them leave those states? Do they go to the 16 states that have state established exchanges?
They're probably already there. The big companies are already there.
They just contract, essentially?
Yeah, just contract. And keep in mind that the big insurance companies, the individual market is not necessarily their biggest, what they call, book of business. They also sell to employers, which are exempt from all of this.
Okay.
So they would focus more and more on their employer business, which many of them have historically anyway.
So the irony is, you know, what we were saying when we were talking about the failure of the website, essentially, is that this is really impacting a small amount of Americans, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
And so from a political standpoint, it was never going to have the salience that it was sold to us as having.
That's true.
That was my opinion.
That's true.
You know, the website's failing. It looks bad, but... In terms of the experiences of a lot of these are people who are very excited at the prospect of getting insurance.
Sure.
And then it's a smaller subset who are not. And again, we're only talking about, you know, whatever it is, in this case, 11 million people. That's a lot of people to be suffering. But it's not a lot of people in terms of a political salience of a website not working.
Yeah, exactly.
Because this idea, do you think it will be a political problem for Republicans?
I do.
Tell me how that happens.
Well, because what will happen, it'll be kind of the reverse of the dynamic we had when the Affordable Care Act was being debated. Then people who were uninsured were hoping to get coverage. Now they have coverage, and you'll be taking something away from them. And when you take something away, when you threaten to take something away from them and then actually do that, there's hell to pay for that. People will, and the news media will be all over this, reporting what happens to those people. You'll see one horror story after another about people who lost their insurance. People will be dying. I think that has the potential of being very devastating for the Republican Party.
You know, here's my... that scenario makes sense to me, but the other scenario where they say, like, this is the Supreme Court, and we said from the very beginning that this Obamacare, nobody knew what was in it. It was 1,000 pages long. You know, who would ever read anything that was over, you know, whatever, 75 pages,
right,
and not with pictures? This is, we warned you about this. Now, we didn't have anything to do. It was the Supreme Court, and we're perfectly willing to go to Congress and fix it if the Democrats would just get on board of getting rid of all these things in the first place.
Right.
I mean, why won't we see that scenario?
Well, we probably will. We actually will. The title of my book is Deadly Spin. That will be the spin that they will try to put on this, that it's not their fault. It's the Supreme Court making this decision about a law that they didn't support in the first place. So, yeah, that's exactly what their spin will be. And they may prevail if that is what we've seen over the past 5 years is they've been very, very effective in shaping public opinion about this law in ways that are not quite the same as reality.
Do you, w- w- would you be aware, and are you aware, or vice versa, I guess, of any plan that the Democrats have, or not so much Democrats, but activists in the healthcare arena, of what the fix would be? I mean, if there's going to be a battle, and the Republicans are going to come out and say, like, we got to scrap this whole thing, we'll meet you in Congress, why not go further with the solution that the Democrats or the you know, that the healthcare activists want? In other words, at least go to the negotiating table and asking for something beyond, we're just going to get you off the hook for this.
I think they need to. I think advocates will, it might present an opportunity for them to do that. I think it will be necessary for them to do that. I think it will shift to the states, though, immediately, because there will be a need in the very short term to try to see if the states might act to restore the
Right, because that's really where the pressure could be. You don't even need necessarily a legislative fix on the federal end.
Right.
You could actually just have a different choice made at the state level.
Yeah, the states could act.
What would you change at this point? I mean, if you went into negotiations on a federal level and somebody said, look, you got to go in and have an ask that's greater than just, can we just interpret the law the way that it was supposed to be?
Right.
What would you ask for?
Well, what I would do was what I think the Democrats should have done in the first place is ask for a plan that really does achieve universal coverage. The Affordable Care Act doesn't get us nearly close enough, and it doesn't do enough to control costs. There are a lot of things that other countries have been able to implement that have both achieved universal coverage and control cost. We haven't done that yet. The Affordable Care Act doesn't go nearly far enough to do either one of those yet.
And so advisory boards, is that what we need? Or
advisory boards is one thing, but to get some of the best thinkers. But also you're going to have, like in neighboring Maryland here, they for some years now have had what's called an all-payer system in which the government actually takes more an active role in setting health care, the cost of hospital care, for example. And I think we're going to have something like that across the rest of the country.
Wendell Potter, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Sam.
And again, the book is, well, both books, Deadly Spin and Obamacare, What's in It for Me, which, of course, tells us what's in it for us and what's actually in the law.
That's right.
Did you, in that book, did you cover the notion? I mean, did anybody even contemplate that there was this little, because... Why would you? I mean, if you interpret it in any way, right?
No. And I, you know, as you did, we watched this law being written, and there was never any anticipation of anything like this. It was never intended, so no one ever gave it any thought.
I don't even think anybody on the right really did either.
No, they didn't. No. They absolutely didn't. No.
Wendell Potter, thanks so much.
Thanks, Sam. Take care.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Wendell Potter on the program. And started to get that clicking at the end of that interview as well, but not so bad. All right, so let's try and go with the with an interview I did with Congresswoman Barbara Lee this morning, just an hour or two ago, here steps away from the Supreme Court building, and give you any further updates that we have in terms of opinions as to how this court case is going to go. I just read a piece by Ian Millhiser, who I spoke to yesterday, may end up running the interview or not. Maybe we'll just include it in the days coming ahead or talk to him about his thoughts. But based upon his interpretation of the questions anyways, he was encouraged, at least by Anthony Kennedy's concern, that if the law had been set up in such a way that it would have punished states for not starting their exchange, it would have been considered too coercive. Not sure. I guess that in his instance, it would be on some type of federalist grounds. I mean, I would anticipate seeing, you know, multiple, as we often get, multiple different perspectives in terms of the dissent and the ruling in this case. But according to Ian Millhiser, he thinks that the court could rule 6-3. in shooting down the plaintiffs. There were some court watchers, I guess, who held out hope that Scalia would hold fast to precedents that were set in this case regarding Chevron in terms of deference to executive agencies, or that he would be consistent with his means in which interpreting the intent of a statute. Of course, no. I mean, let's be honest. So it remains to be seen. We're not going to know the results of this until June or July. There was also apparently the question of standing, which really hadn't been addressed in the circuit courts or even in the lower court levels. That was raised by Justice Ginsburg, apparently discussed at length by the Solicitor General Varelli. The standing had to do with projections of income. As you may or may not know, when you sign up through the exchange, it asks you to project your income over the next year. If your income is larger than projected, gets you outside of, or I guess theoretically smaller too, it would change the level of subsidy that you get. In the case of the plaintiffs, it's quite possible that all four of them would have been exempt for one reason or another, including Medicare eligibility, including Veteran Affairs health care, a VA health care eligibility, and including having an income that, even with the subsidies, would have put their cost of health care at greater than 9% of their income, in which case they would have received a hardship exemption. And if that's the case, and they don't have to buy insurance, they have no real complaint in a legal sense. They have no injury. They're not being forced to do anything. And so they have no standing to bring this case because they're not really a party to it. I'm not quite sure to what extent standing will be an issue, but that was definitely something that was raised. But, and according to court watchers, when John Roberts is silent at the oral argument stage, it means that he's keeping his options open. So, again, we'll see. Here is an interview that I did earlier with Congresswoman Barbara Lee. I'll be back in a moment. Continuing our coverage from the Supreme Court of the United States as the court hears King versus Burwell, a case that could have huge implications for the Affordable Care Act, causing millions literally to lose their health insurance. Joining me now is Congresswoman Barbara Lee. She is from California's 13th Congressional District. Thanks so much for joining me, Congressman.
My pleasure.
So give us a sense. I mean, do you have a sense that any of your Republican colleagues who have been attempting to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act for years now have any solution to what they could potentially rot upon the act?
Absolutely not. They want to repeal it. They don't even want to replace it. This is strictly an attack on President Obama and his agenda and his legacy. I want to remind you that when Senator Mitch McConnell said early on in the president's tenure as president, their first priority was to make sure he was a one-term president. When that did not happen, then they began their effort to undermine each and everything that he has done. Now, of course, they're trying to take away health care coverage for 10 million people. And for me, I say that is very cruel, it's very unusual, and they should just stop it.
I mean, do you get a sense that any of the Republicans in the House are concerned about this? I mean, and they don't seem to be able to do anything. Never mind address almost like a catastrophic event like what would happen days after. I guess presumably the court was to find that somehow people in these states are not eligible for subsidies.
I have no idea what's on their mind. You know, when you look at the fact that it's mostly red states that have not expanded Medicaid, well, come on, you know, they have constituents who need this health care coverage also. They don't seem to care. They've right. tried to repeal this over 50-some times. And so I just say to them, they need to stop it. They need to do their job, and they need to realize that 10 million people deserve health care coverage. Everyone in the greatest and most powerful industrialized country in the world should have health care coverage for everyone. Health care should be a basic right.
Let me turn to some other recent issues. You were one of the, I believe, the sole member of Congress to vote against George Bush's authorization, original authorization to use of military force on this so-called war on terror. Give me your sense about your feelings on the president coming to Congress a couple of weeks ago now, seeking a new Iraqi and perhaps not just Iraqi authorization to use of military force.
I've been trying since July or August with my colleagues in a bipartisan way to get the Congress to debate a new authorization. This is 7 months now into this war, and it is a war, and the American people deserve to hear a debate and deserve to have their members of Congress on record voting for or against war. And I have to tell you, I'm very pleased the president came forward with a proposal and an authorization. I don't agree with it.
Right.
Until we repeal the one that you mentioned that I voted against, any president can use force, has a blank check without coming to Congress. So until that 2001 resolution is repealed, we're not really doing justice to what the Constitution requires.
In fact, that is what the administration claims is their authorization, or at least part of their authorization in the bombing that's taking place against
Absolutely.
ISIS.
That's what they use as the legal justification, and so we need to repeal that in order to have a fair and full and robust debate on the use of force.
Do you think there has been a fundamental change? I mean, has Congress always been this reluctant to even engage in the debate about these type of things?
I think so. When you look at the horrific events of 9/11 in 2001, I think we had a one-hour debate. You know, it was a blank check. It gave any president the authority, and I believe members then said, well, that's it. You know, whenever any president needs to use force, he has the authority. Well, in case of an imminent threat, any president has the power and right and should use force. But not in this instance as it relates to Afghanistan, Iraq, and now we're talking about, again, Iraq and Syria and ISIS. And, you know, the American people deserve better, and we should have this debate and vote.
The Justice Department is reportedly coming out today with, I think either today or tomorrow, with a scathing report about the Ferguson Police Department. And it appears from initial reports that they could be suing the department for civil rights violations, sort of systemic civil rights problems in that. Give me your sense. I mean, we seem to have this rash, and I don't know that it's particularly new, frankly. Maybe we're just reporting it more, of unarmed black men being killed by police. We're seeing the sort of systemic abuse of African-American civil rights by the police. Is there any chance of this becoming sort of a national electoral or political issue, aside from sort of, we've got one case in Cleveland, we've got one case in Ferguson, we've got one case in Oakland. I mean, is there Is there anything from that we can expect from the political class, or are we just going to see activists on the ground?
No, we should see activists on the ground because of the street heat, political leaders will respond. It's extremely important to recognize this is systemic. It's long-term. I raised two African-American young men, young boys, in the 70s, and I come from Oakland where, if you remember, the Black Panther Party led an effort to really address police misconduct and brutality. And so I think now the press is focusing on it. But this is a long-term systemic institutional problem that the African-American community has been dealing with for generations, really.
I mean, do you think that there's going to be any change? I mean, are you in any way heartened at least by, you know, we've got a rollback of stop and frisk, maybe not to the levels that it should be, but at least down by 90% over the course of the past year, I guess, with de Blasio?
I believe that it's going to be, again, the power of people in the streets pushing elected officials to change some of these policies. And I'm very pleased that the Justice Department came out with this report, because it's not only Ferguson. It's all across the country, and it's going to have to take some law change, some legal kinds of challenges to these laws to really make these changes. It's not going to be just incremental reforms. I mean, reforms are good. Police departments need to reform. We need to have sensitivity training. We need to have more racial kinds of sensitivity strategies. So, you know, police officers who don't live in the community really understand the culture and the background of people and what is taking place. So we have to have these incremental reforms, but we have to have law changes, and we have to have grand jury reform, and we have to have all of the reforms and institutional biases addressed in a legal way, and that is extremely important. And I think the Justice Department and communities, and again, Ferguson and other communities, have to be political in their overall efforts. We have to register to vote. You have to vote for elected officials and people you think who are going to make these changes, and take those out by not voting for them who are not.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California's 13th District, I appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us. All right, folks, we're going to do a freebie Wednesday, I guess, today. And there's a chance Brian Beutler may be joining us later in the program. He's just, I guess, filed from the bowels of the Supreme Court. He's just filed his dispatch from listening in on the arguments. I'm back up now. How's that? So we may have Brian Beutler with us. And I think what we'll do is start taking some IMs. Just a couple of stories that I will probably end up getting to over the next couple of days. Well, there was one. I don't know if I'm going to get into this too much. Sort of a classic NPR report on four reasons both parties should be sweating bullets over King versus Burwell. The biggest political threat is to the president, according to NPR. Let me just read this to you. I just find it so annoying that it's really just venting on my part. So this is number one. The biggest political threat is to the president. It's Mara Liasson. A ruling for the plaintiffs would be a mortal blow to the president's signature legislative achievement. Up to 8 million people could lose their subsidies in 34 states, leaving them unable to afford coverage. Premiums would spike because presumably only the sickest people would be willing to pay the full cost of coverage. Insurers would leave the market. It would delegitimize the law. Democrats have been touting its success, around 11 million people signing up and enjoying a momentary lull in the intensity of the arguments over the law would have to scramble to preserve what they could. The political slugfest over the Affordable Care Act would begin. So I don't know how this is a political threat to the president, perhaps theoretically his legacy. the idea that if the Supreme Court crashes law, it would somehow politically damage him. It just seems absurd. The political slugfest of the Affordable Care Act would begin. It seems like it's ongoing. I don't know. I don't know what I found really annoying about that. And then and number two was Republicans might not be the winners. And then number three was it would be hard for Republicans to unify around a replacement for Obamacare. She doesn't seem to even realize, like, well, the argument would be there's no recognition that this would be fought out in the states. I imagine if a state is so inclined, it's not inconceivable to me that by executive action, the governor could say, we're taking over the exchange. And we're going to contract back to the federal government the ability to run it. You know, during Passover, where Jews are not supposed to own any bread, you're not supposed to have any bread in your house during Passover. My dad, who's an attorney, who represented a bakery. It's like a bagel shop. Owned by a Jew. The owner of the bagel shop would sell the business for the 8 days of Passover for a dollar to a friend of his who was a Gentile. And then he would buy it back for a dollar. It seems to me that if you have two willing parties, there's some transaction that can be made here. The real problem would be in states controlled by Republican governors who are not inclined to help out the law, and that's where the focal point of the pressure would be, seems to me. But according to Mara Liasson, it would all be on the Democrats, and then Republicans might not be winners. It would be hard for Republicans to unify a replacement for Obamacare. Of course, there's no replacement for this. This is as far... There's no practical solution to deliver what the Affordable Care Act does that is to the right of the Affordable Care Act. And then finally, she does admit Republican governors would be under tremendous pressure. Meanwhile, other stories that we will be talking about tomorrow. Secretary of State Clinton's emails. I'm not quite sure there's that much there. The fallout from Benjamin Netanyahu's speech, which I also think equally, there's not that much there. I don't think he's going to be able to scuttle the Iran deal. What happens in terms of Israeli domestic politics, that's another question. Meanwhile, in Alabama, the Alabama Supreme Court ordered probate judges around the state to stop issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples, ruling in direct opposition to a federal judge that the state's ban on same-sex marriage was illegal. So I don't know what happens here, frankly. I can only imagine that the next step would be perhaps, I don't know. In fact, maybe this is something I've got to ask if we have any more legal experts around here. If the Supreme Court could oversee that. I mean, in the decision, apparently the judges insisted they could interpret the state's constitution independently from and even contrary to federal courts. But that doesn't seem to be the issue. The issue seems to be that the state's constitution is unconstitutional under the federal constitution. which is, I'm not sure if there's precedent for this type of thing, at least in recent history. I don't know that the Alabama State Court like has the jurisdiction or the authority to supersede a federal court on the question of the federal constitution. I don't know what happens next. I don't know if this goes to the U.S. Supreme Court. It doesn't appear that the Alabama State Supreme Court, recognizes the federal court's authority. So I don't know if the National Guard gets called in or, frankly, or what happens here. I'm trying to find some commentary on it, like legal people. Also, I think there was a story just the other day regarding Russ Feingold. I think it was in the Huffington Post about him reaching out to potential funders, suggesting that he was planning on running for Senate, or that he's exploring the idea of running for Senate in 2016. And on Facebook yesterday, he's leaving the State Department. He's been working as a special envoy to various countries, I believe, in Africa. By all accounts, I think it was one piece I read. I haven't followed up on it in a long time, but looked like he may have avoided a war. Well, you know, that's... don't all get the opportunity to do that. But he did write, after I leave the State Department this week, I'm going to spend portions of 2015 teaching, blah, blah, blah. I will be living at home in Wisconsin, from where I will travel the state extensively. I will listen carefully to my fellow Wisconsinites talk about their concerns, especially those involving their economic well-being. I will also seek their counsel on how I can best further serve my country and the state I love. So, I don't... my sense is that he's not gearing up to become a commentator on MSNBC or Fox News. That sounds like somebody who's going to run for something that involves either the state or the country. So, I don't know. But worth keeping an eye on. Also, story out of New York City, which is sure to... I mean, I can only imagine. I haven't searched around for this, but I can only imagine. Story came out an hour or two ago. New York City schools will close for the Muslim holiday Eid. So I guess Eid falls on September 24th. Eid al-Adha. And then there's Eid al-Fitr, which happens over the summer, and I guess the summer school will be off for that day too. But so there'll be another day off for students in New York, and I'm sure Pam Geller, I don't know, maybe she'll light herself on fire on the steps of City Hall. Is it wrong for me to chuckle when I say that? I'm trying to convey I'm trying to be comedic in conveying the sense of outrage that I think Pam Geller will be experiencing. She finds out that these Muslim kids are allowed to take the day off and everybody's going to have the day off school. Meanwhile, brain surgeon Ben Carson says that homosexuality is a choice. He's got proof. I haven't dug into the piece to find out how he proves it. But, I mean, is this... apparently he made the comments this morning to CNN's Chris Cuomo. I mean, seriously. If you're running for president, just from a political standpoint, don't you have enough common sense to realize. And even Ben Carson, I mean, look, I'm sure a certain percentage of Ben Carson's support, and it's probably a significant one, comes from the fact that he's homophobic. But they already know that. He's not, I mean, who is he reaching now at this point? What is the political calculation? I got to get on, when I get on national TV, I got to make sure that I let my homophobic freak flag fly. I think this guy has a compulsion. I think I don't think he's trying to convince anybody beyond himself, perhaps his family. But I will talk more about that tomorrow. Also, apparently, according to a Russian lawyer for Edward Snowden, Snowden is interested in and was working with American and German lawyers in an attempt to return back to the United States. We shall see. Of course, I mentioned it in the interview with Congresswoman Lee. That regarding the imminent Justice Department report finding a pattern of police bias and excessive force in Ferguson. Also stories on some students who are involved in a student loan boycott. Encouraging. So we will get to all of those. In the meantime, I will also take your phone calls at 646-257-3920 if I have any time to do so. And I will read your IMs. You can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. Let's see. We have somebody on the phone right now. Let's give it a try. Calling from a 914 area code. Who's this?
Jeremo,
how's it going, buddy?
Good. Jeremo, Sam.
Hi, Jeremo. Can you hear me?
Going good, Sammy. Sammy, even though there's a couple mishaps today, it's still a great show. Sam, I can hear you, but can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes. Jeremo, I can hear you. Well.
Okay, I don't think it's coming together, but Sammy, okay, can I just real quick, Sammy?
Yeah.
I want to say that this is such a complicated issue, and, you know, after hearing Wendell Potter say that now that prices are going to go up on your on people's insurance, it's demoralizing.
Yeah, it is demoralizing. I mean, I think I would imagine that the plaintiffs don't rule, I mean, that the court does not rule in favor of the plaintiffs, there's going to be much less of an increase. But look, you know, it's not like health insurance was trending down anyways. Supposedly, and I don't know that we have the complete story yet, but it appears that in general, in the aggregate cost of insurance, at least the rate of increases has slowed. But yeah, I mean, look, we still have a massive problem with the cost of healthcare in this country. It is largely, though, still a function of the cost of medical care. And, you know, of things like drugs. You know, I rode down on the train down to Washington, D.C. with a guy who works in the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, he perfectly nice guy. You know, was trying to tell me that, look, you know, you can't have things like the government negotiating for a price a volume discount, you know, through Medicare and Medicaid, because then we wouldn't, the drug companies wouldn't have the opportunity for research and development. And, you know, I'm sorry. It would cut into profits. That's right. It would cut into profits, just like every other business that you have someone who buys a lot. You got to negotiate with them, and it cuts into your profits a little bit. I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of problems with the cost of healthcare, but I'm not sure that this specific case, unless it is they find for the plaintiffs, is going to be a biggest is going to be a dramatic driver of it. Let's put it that way. Well, I think we lost Jeremo, but...
No, you didn't lose me, Sam.
Oh, okay.
Sammy, you didn't lose me.
All right.
Sammy, just real quick.
Yeah?
Now, you know, you didn't lose me, Sam.
Okay, go ahead,
Jeremo. We got a lot of back feedback. But, Sammy, just real quick. For a typographical, a typo error on this bill to destroy this whole, the Affordable Care Act, you know, if you really look at it, it's almost as though, you know, there's a war on the liberal ideas. And let's go back to what Bush said. You're either with us or against us. And they're going to use everything they can to destroy the lifestyle of the average American at this point.
Yeah, no kidding, Jeremo. I mean, yes. Agreed. You know. Hope Springs.
Sam, I want you to talk about that because you explain everything so well, and you know.
All right. Well, I mean, Jeremo, I think you're right. I'm going to let you go, buddy. I appreciate the phone call. The reality is here that this is, you know, these guys. There were some guys at the Cato Institute who they really wanted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. And they threw a lot of stuff up against the wall. That's why there was such massive disappointment in 2012 when it didn't get destroyed in the last Affordable Care Act case. And they're going to continue to do it. You know, will this mark the end of legal challenges? I don't know. It's much harder to get rid of something after it's been in place for a couple of years. That's just the reality of it. Let's go to the IMs. Sharpie, the view from over here in Australia is weird. When you get your U.S. political news from the Majority Report, Secular Talk and the Young Turks, is America really moving as far to the right as it appears to be despite having a Democrat in the White House? Well, I think that move has been going on for quite some time. Bush and Chains, I just voted. Yes, I voted. Holy cow, folks. This is a big deal. If Bush and Chains voted for the Majority Report at the podcastawards.com, there is no excuse for anyone not to vote. And in the words of Bush and Chains, I say to you, Bush and Chains, keep voting. You can actually vote every day. I challenge my copycat pseudo namesakes to do the same, says Bush and Chains. Thank you. Lawyer Matthew, I voted. Love it. Quintile. This must be what healthcare policy sounds like on Ayahuasca. I don't know. Isn't the Republican plan some vacuous combination of catastrophic care, tort reform, and probability, i.e. more race to the bottom nonsense disguised and repackaged as freedom? Indeed. I'm not sure they can coalesce around that, but that's the general outlines. Chrysler, don't despair, Sam. The recordings clearly all suffer this issue. Therefore, it is likely a temporary playback issue, not a failure of each recording. I don't know. Agnes, a liberalist, why does SCOTUS make a ruling, then wait months to reveal that ruling? They don't, you know, it's speculation that they make their decision over the next week because they can change up to the last minute. Apparently, John Roberts reversed himself the closer the decision was ruled. And so I think they also just do it because it gives them time. It doesn't create pressure on any particular ruling. I'm sure they have an operational reason for it. And Buonara, Obamacare is unconstitutional because in the Constitution, the Reagan 10th Amendment says, kill me all and let God sort them out. Jay-Z. So what was the mischief that the law was meant to correct? A significant number of people lacked health insurance. Does the law function to address this problem if complained of section is removed? No. Setting that aside, if you are complaining that something is oppressive to you as a state, how is it oppressive if someone else comes along and from somewhere else runs it for you, presumably at no cost to you? No. The plaintiffs are individuals who are saying that they are forced to buy health insurance. And the argument as to why they should get relief is because they live in a state where the federal government runs the exchange. And they are forced to get health insurance because they're eligible for subsidies. The individual. If the subsidies were not given to them, they would be eligible for a hardship because their income would be less than 9%. The cost of health insurance would be greater than 9% of their income. So it is because of the subsidies that these four plaintiffs claim they are forced to buy health insurance, and that in the absence of subsidies, they wouldn't be forced to buy health insurance because they'd be eligible for a hardship case, in which case they wouldn't have to buy health insurance. And so they attack these subsidies as being illegitimate on the grounds that the state didn't establish the exchange. From Kennedy's perspective, he's saying that if we, the Supreme Court, read the law as the intent of the law was to punish states for not setting up their own exchanges and denying them subsidies, that would be coercive on the part of the federal government. So there are two different arguments that are distinct from each other, but they're just centered around the same outcome. It's complicated. I hope I'm explaining it in a way that makes sense to people. Militant apathy. Dude, to tell you the truth, I saw the crap about Hillary emails, and all I could think about was the goddamn roller coaster ride we supporters all went through with the last Clinton administration. With all of their gifts, I just don't understand why they are so effing undisciplined, and I will say squishy when it comes to doing their business. Drives me crazy. You know, I tend to agree that I'm not convinced there was anything nefarious about this, but politically it's sloppy. I don't understand why no one at any given point said, let's set up a State Department email just because everybody does. We're not obligated to keep all the correspondence on that email address. But let's just do it to keep it from being messy. I don't know why that happened. I don't know. And I agree. It's just tiresome. Milton Apathy. And the thing with Lindsey Graham, are you effing serious? What grown-ass man makes a comment about a woman's facial surgeries, straight or gay? It has nothing to do with his sexuality, but that was total bitch move. Remember, Bill kept all those F-wads like Mark Penn and Dick Morris around for some reason. Just wait till Lanny Davis floats to the surface. No kidding. Ferguson Police Department looks like it's going to go away rather than submit to a DOJ oversight, and it should. That prosecutor should be disbarred, too. Restraint coaching, retraining seminars won't change a thing. You have to change the culture. Police will only change when they're at risk of going to jail. Trust me. Jimmy Reefer Cake. Regarding what Republicans would do to replace Obamacare, I don't think they really give a crap, whether the policy is to the left or the right, as long as they can claim ownership. That's the moment that they will start to tout the benefits. They may say something like, well, look, we eliminated a bunch of pages from this massive federal law because Obamacare is really a Republican law and huge benefits to private insurance. My view is that it's all a huge distraction from real solutions to cutting costs to health care. Exactly right from Jeremy. Well said. You can't trust these people, and I think they... So the whole thing was a compromise of the true liberal system that we would envision, which is caring for the poor. Isn't it obvious that Queen Hillary and her minions are above the rules? I don't know how to respond to any of that, Jimmy. Whiz fan, Sam, remember when Feingold told you that Obama was going to be a great president when he gets a second term? Best joke ever. I think he's been certainly been better since the midterms, for what it's worth. And it's worth something, you know, in terms of like Cuban relations and perhaps a deal with Iran and maybe if all goes well with the deferred action for, I mean, there's some net neutrality. The reality is that I don't care why you did it. It has worked out well since the midterm elections. Charlie, regarding drug R&D, why not give grants to universities to do the research? Give them a small royalty for whatever they discover and let manufacturers compete to produce. Am I crazy? No, you're just bathed in your commie ideology. Okajik, hi, Sam. I voted and verified. Keep up the good work. Thank you. Jay Tingle. I too voted, and I see Adam Carolla was selected to the Podcast Hall of Fame. So you're in good company. Oh, God. Majority Report Zach. Overheard in the Supreme Court. You want health care? Mazel tov, mofo. Should try and find the Paris plaintiff and get her on the air. We must find out how she's liking your trip to D.C. And Bonara. Obamacare is unconstitutional because in the Constitution. I hate autocratic. Kill them all, I see. That's toast. If you're voting for the majority, it's easy. Do it. Cost of insurance will increase regardless of the insurance company's profit driven. We'll always look to buy their stock and get back in Congress to make any major change in prices down.
That must be our focus in 2016. I would only hope that would be the agenda. Nevertheless.
Greg, from now on, I will not be talking less about libertarian. I will not be talking less about libertarian. I mean, I will be defending less libertarian stuff. And Milton, you know who. And more about my actual interests and views, which are around socialism and automation. I'm glad to hear that. That's excellent. Jay-Z, thanks for that explanation. It makes it a lot clearer for me. Are you compelled to take out car insurance to drive in the U.S.? Yes. But of course, you know, driving is a privilege that you can either opt in or opt out of. I mean, it is a different dynamic with health insurance, but nevertheless, you're compelled to take out retirement insurance in the form of Social Security. Your lack of health insurance causes harm to others by having, for example, to pick you up when you collapse in the street. Audio has gone to robo voice hell. Oh, wait a second. I don't know what did that. There's nothing I did different. How is it now? Still? Oh, God. All right, folks, I'm going to wrap it up. All right, I'm getting two different things that I'm hearing from Matt and Michael. The word no does not tell me. I don't know what's going on. Excuse me. I think your phone might be interfering with the thing. I don't know what it is. Just going to have to cut out some of that stuff. All right, folks, I'm going to have to wrap up the show. We're just having, I don't know what the problems are technically. Matt and Michael, I will send you the updates to those interviews. I have no idea what that was. I don't know what that noise is. All right, folks. I will be back in studio tomorrow, blessedly. See you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the rope that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. The months shifted into years, while I shifted in and out of. Right.